brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast, a show that is fast approaching its fourth anniversary. It was launched in the summer of 2021, that famous Brian Adams B-side. And I've been thinking, you know, it's 130-odd episodes that we've published to date. And I know the beauty of podcasting is that when you're picking up new listeners all the time, you know, a lot of those folks are prepared to binge through the back catalogues and stuff like that. And that's great. But I'm aware as well that a lot of listeners just don't do that. And, you know, we've got a lot of what I'd consider fantastic conversations in that archive that, you know, many listeners might simply not hear or not even be aware of. So what I'm going to do going forward is bring you a classic conversation, a re-roll. I'm tying it into the hobby there. We're going to listen to a previous conversation, you know, with somebody. Well, today's guest is going to be Joe McCulloch. Joe's been on the podcast a few times now, but this was his very first appearance on the show. Career-defining moment for him. Probably not. But yeah, this is going back to 2021. First time I had Joe on the show. And we were mainly talking about Frostgrave. You know, we've had a lot of different conversations since then. But yeah, a lot of the focus here was on Frostgrave, but we also got into like the Stargrave and the Silver Bayonet as well. So I kicked things off by asking Joe how the hobby landscape and market generally looked back when Frostgrave was released compared to today. And the irony is not lost on me that when we talk about today, we actually mean 2021. But as far as I could see, not a whole lot has changed between 21 and what year are we in now? 2025. Can't even remember the year. That's a good sign. But, you know, Frostgrave was released in 2015, I'm sure. And when we were talking in 2021, that's a little bit more time had passed then, but I think a lot more happened in that time period. I'm prepared to be corrected if I'm wrong. I often am wrong. Anyway, let's get into the conversation with Joe from back in the day and hear what he had to say to that.
I think Games Workshop looked really different. So 2015 was the year they killed the old world and kind of sent shockwaves through fantasy gaming. And that probably actually proved really helpful because I think a lot of people were like really disgusted and just ready to find something else. And there it was, you know, just by virtue of luck. But I do think also right around that time, maybe a little before, but you started to see a really noticeable increase in the quality of smaller games. So people like Osprey got into publishing, or you had new companies springing up like Warlord or something that you know, actual companies started to publish these games that in the decade before probably would have been self-published. And so bringing that resource, you know, of artwork, of just printing quality to it. So I think, whereas 10 years ago, if you wanted a really kind of nice looking book, you only had a couple of choices. You know, you had Games Workshop and maybe a few others, but now you've got a lot of choice between books that look, you know, generally all of really quite professional quality. And so really kind of, it's made it a much broader playing field, because whereas before a lot of those games, A, would have been hard to attain, but also may have been like kind of poo-pooed by some people because of the less than professional look of them.
I grew up with Games Workshop in the 90s, in the sort of early to mid 90s. And, you know, to me, a game, a miniatures game, it was the rules, it was the miniatures, it was the whole thing. Yeah. I have heard from sort of people older than I am about the old Hammer era, where there was a kind of different ethos of like the bring what you have and the use what you have.
Yeah.
And when I got back into the hobby a couple of years ago, the miniature agnostic concept was very new to me, and I was very surprised and delighted about it.
Right.
Do you think there's a nod to that older era with the miniature agnostic systems? Because we do see a lot of them now.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things going on. One, obviously, if you're just writing a game, as an individual, you don't have miniatures. So, you know, it has to be kind of miniatures agnostic by default. And, you know, there is an element of that to Frostgrave, even though it does have miniatures. It was written thinking there wouldn't be. But also, I just, for me, miniatures games have always been agnostic. You know, I've never really worried about these are the miniatures that go with this game. I guess that just kind of goes back to my childhood and starting with Dungeons and Dragons, where it was kind of like, oh, here's a miniature I can use for it. But also just those early days of wargaming when even the companies like Games Workshop that had miniatures often didn't have miniatures to represent all of the stuff in the game. Or, yeah, there is more of an open idea of, like, create your own monsters or whatever, so that if you found a cool miniature, you could just plop it in there. And yeah, that's just something that's never left me. And when I came to, in fact, it's, I was kind of the other way in that I never fully realized how much of the industry thought differently to me, how much most people came into the hobby through one specific game, generally Games Workshop, but not necessarily, and thus saw the hobby just through that one game. Here's the game, here's the miniatures, and thus always thought, if I go to another game, there'll be miniatures for it. And so it really wasn't until Frostgrave came out and a lot of people started saying, wow, this is amazing, I've never even kind of thought of playing games this way. It occurred to me, it's like, wow, there's a lot of people playing games a different way. So quite interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because I almost had the same attitude myself. And you were talking about when they blew the old world up. So I was unaware of that. And I think it was maybe like late 2018 and it was going into the winter. And I just had this itch and I was reading some of the old Black Library books. And I thought, You know what? I'm going to have a bit of a Google, see how Warhammer's doing these days. And then a couple of like the top blog posts, it was like old world blown up. And I was like, oh no.
It's gone.
I always liked to thought, like for all those years I was out of the hobby, I always liked to thought that I could just, you know, when you've seen a Games Workshop.
I can get back in whenever I want.
Yeah. You know, like the ex-heroin addict, he knows that his dealer's there.
Yeah.
Should he want to get back into it? So it was very, I wouldn't say traumatic, that's quite dramatic. But then it led me to finding stuff like Kings of War, which seemed a natural replacement. And they kind of came to the table with a bit of a miniatures agnostic approach at the time, because they obviously just wanted people to like come in with their old Warhammer armies. But it wasn't long before I discovered Frostgrave as well. So do you think that, like, do you think it was a perfect, I mean, I'm not taking anything away from the great game that you created, but do you think there was a perfect set of conditions when you created Frostgrave, when you released it in its first edition, that's led to it being just such a popular and cult game?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes right down to it, any kind of publishing, any kind of creative endeavor, you know, so much of its success is going to be based on luck. You know, that's not to say my game is good or bad or any individual game is good or bad, but even if a game is really good, if it's going to kind of become popular, it's got to have a huge amount of luck. And yeah, I think Frostgrave did benefit from that. I mean, like I said, it came right at that old world blowing up time. It came at a time when, in many ways, despite blowing up the world, old world, Games Workshop seemed really set in its ways and had kind of abandoned a lot of the games that people love, you know, most notably in this conversation, Mordheim. You know, a lot of people wanted that, were looking for that small skirmish fantasy game, and it wasn't really out there. So I got lucky that I came at a time when, you know, there wasn't kind of a competitor for it immediately available. And in fact, at that time, Games Workshop wasn't really supporting any kind of the smaller games that I think they just hadn't realized that gaming society had moved on a bit. And as a lot of us have gotten older, we're looking for shorter play games and games that had less painting commitment, you know, games that just didn't dominate your life quite so much because, you know, you're older and you've got kids and you've got a job and you just don't have the time to put into it anymore. So I got really lucky in that sense. I also got really lucky in a couple of other ways. So Osprey was just kind of really becoming something in the gaming field. In fact, like, so up to that point, Osprey had published a war game series, and Frostgrave became the first book they did to have the Osprey Games logo. So it became its own separate entity. So I think it got some good press through that. Osprey hired an incredible artist for it, a guy, Dmitry Bermak, a Russian artist who's now done all kinds of things. He's doing magic cards and worked for Pathfinder, I believe, and stuff. And just, I think, brought a really different look to fantasy gaming again, whereas a lot of people had been seeing either the grimdark kind of fantasy, or they'd been seeing the very kind of Tolkien-esque fantasy. Suddenly in wargaming, there was this much more kind of Dungeons and Dragons, pulpy, fun kind of fantasy. You know, it's like these colorful wizards, and you know, there's nothing necessarily dark or moody about it. It can be if you want it to be, but it can also just kind of be fun and adventurous. And so I think that was big. And then North Star got involved and you know, started to make figures for it, which is just, you know, as much as I love miniature as agnostic, there's nothing like miniatures to advertise your game, because it's just always, hey, look at these new miniatures in it, you know. And that's probably why most of us are in this hobby, is because we love little miniatures and we love looking at miniatures. Every time we see a new miniature and, you know, it's for Frostgrave, then you're going to hear that name Frostgrave and you can hopefully be intrigued. And also go ahead.
No, I was just going to say how much say did you have over the aesthetic of the miniatures? But don't let me throw you off your train of thought.
Well, I mean, one thing, the last point I was going to add was, some of the early miniatures were sculpted by Mark Copplestone, who's kind of an old school big name in miniature sculpting. And he hadn't done any fantasy figures for years. And why, to be honest, he did some Frostgrave ones, I don't know. But I think just like having that name attached to it too, people are like, oh, Copplestone's back. He's doing some fantasy figures, you know, and that just has people sit up and take notice. Sorry, what was your question?
How much say did you have over the aesthetic of the miniatures?
As much as I wanted, I guess, would be the kind of truth. But the truth is, so I think very much in words, and I find other artistic outlets very difficult to think about and imagine. And I know that's weird, because, like, you know, people think, well, you're creating fantasy worlds, and I am. So I do have occasional snapshots, but really I'm thinking in concepts and words. And so when it comes to doing things like the artwork, so I brief the artwork, but my artwork briefs are pretty brief. and I rely a lot on the artist to bring to life kind of what I'm trying to say. And that's true, whether that's, you know, painting, or whether that's sculpting. And so in general, I kind of let other people drive the look of the figures for any of the games, really. I mean, a lot of it will be taken directly from that artwork. So obviously it kind of comes from my brief, goes to the artist, and then goes to a sculptor. But you know, very often you could look at my brief and not be able to connect it to the figure that eventually comes out. So again, really lucky that a lot of talented people are, you know, supporting me by using their ability to bring something to the game that I could never do.
Yeah, I suppose in any creative project, there's a lot to be said by just finding the right group of people that you trust and just letting them do their job, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious, because Frostgrave is so popular and influential, you're bound to come across in your time a couple of other games which are a bit cheeky. Have you ever came across like a snow crypt or something?
You know, I, for the most part, I don't worry about it, or I try not to worry about it at any rate. You know, there's so many games out there, and there's so many ideas, and really we're all building on what has gone before, you know, like Frostgrave doesn't exist probably if Dungeons and Dragons doesn't exist, if Games Workshop doesn't exist, you know, while I'm not trying obviously to steal anything from them, their influence in my gaming and just in my thought process is huge. And I know that's going to be true for people going forward. You know, they're going to see the lessons from Frostgrave and draw their own kind of conclusions from that. And some of that's going to filter into their own game design. And that's, you know, as long as you're not flat out, you know, purposely trying to just redo what I already did, and pass it off as your own, it's quite an honor to think that people might be influenced by what I've done and try to bring some of that to their game design. But beyond that, I mean, like, you know, I own the trademark for Frostgrave, but you know, the last thing I want to do obviously is get into a legal fight with anybody over anything. So that's not fun. And,
We'll cut to an ad now for my new game, Snowcrypt, coming winter 2021. Get your pre-orders in, folks.
Exactly. You know, a lot of people actually did write me when Frosthaven was announced, so the new kind of game from Gloomhaven. And
is that a thing? I didn't know that.
It kickstarted last year, I guess, so I don't know whether it's actually out yet or not. And, you know, obviously, the word Frosthaven is pretty close to the word Frostgrave, but, you know, they're different things. And to be honest, they probably weren't even aware of Frostgrave, or if they were, they didn't think about it as they were doing that. But at the same time, you know, it's a different type of game, and there's plenty of room for both in the market. So I decided, you know what? I don't care.
Well, the imitation is the highest form of flattery.
Exactly.
So Frostgrave, snow, frost, cold. Why the setting that you chose? I know I've listened to a lot of different interviews with you, and I know that you talk about how you're not enforcing that setting on people. You know that they could play on a tropical island if they want. But why the frozen city? Why choose that aesthetic?
Yeah. So originally, when I started working on the game, and I'd forgotten this, but I found some old notes not too long ago, and I found like my original blurb for the game, and it was actually set in a desert. It was actually set in a desert ruined city.
Sandgrave.
Yeah, it was essentially Sandgrave, and I think as I was working on it, a couple of things happened. I wanted the city to seem very dead. and the more I thought about it, I was like, but, you know, dead and dry has been done a lot. Why don't I try something a little different and make it dead and frozen? Because, you know, what's more than dead is dead and frozen. You know, it's like, so I don't know. And then once I kind of got that little idea in my head, it was just like, you know what, that's just not been done very much, you know, but it also gives you this idea that, like, not only is this kind of the other players are against you and any kind of traps and stuff in the city are against you, but even the weather is against you, you know, it's just a really miserable place to be.
Sounds like Scotland. Scotland Grave, make that next
year.
I'll play that. Yeah. I'll play that every day when I leave my house.
And also, and you know, this is one of those things that I don't know how much influence it had, but kind of retrospectively, I think quite a bit. A year or two before I wrote Frostgrave, I surprised my wife with a romantic getaway to Tallinn, the capital of Estonia. And because literally I'd seen a picture of it on a website somewhere. And it was like, cool old medieval city. I'm like, that looks great. We're going. So I booked tickets for the middle of February, and not realizing just how far north Estonia is, And it was only like after I'd booked the tickets and given them to her that I realized that the average temperature was going to be -13 Celsius when we were there. And we got there, the first day we got there, it just dumped snow over everything. And it turned out to be an amazing trip because, like, it is a beautiful city and even more beautiful in the snow. You know, it is this medieval city and the snow makes it all kind of glow and beautiful and covers up, you know, any problems. But it also meant that like we'd go somewhere and you could only spend about 20 minutes outside before you had to dive into a cafe. But I think but that just kind of really stuck in my brain, this idea of this medieval city covered in snow, you know, because there's just, it meant that getting anywhere was hard. And it also meant that like, you never quite knew exactly what you were looking at or what could be around the corner because everything was a little more obscured. So I think that played a huge role in kind of pushing my brain in that direction.
Yeah, when you see a photo online of Frostgrave being played and the form it was maybe originally intended with that setting, it's striking that straight away that is Frostgrave. It's not 40K, it's not Warhammer. You know, you see the snow on the buildings, the ice, stuff like that.
it actually, that's one thing that's, you know, again, kind of a stroke of luck. I stumbled into a game where it was immediately obvious to everybody walking by the table what was being played. And which is funny because I think when I wrote it, part of me was like, nobody's going to like cover their terrain in snow. You know, nobody's going to put snow on the bases of their figures.
Yeah, that brings me on interestingly to what I wanted to ask you next. So take me, for example, I've got a bunch of like miniatures in a cabinet here. They're all goblin green bases and stuff like that. Yeah. And I've got all sorts of terrain. There's no snow on them. So what I could do, you know, with Frostgrave, I could start to get miniatures and base them white and put some snow on buildings and stuff. But then that kind of limits those miniatures and buildings to that particular way that I would play Frostgrave. In your experience in the community, is it pretty much 50-50? You know, are there people who really go down the Frosty aesthetic and are there just people who prefer to play in warmer climates?
Yeah, I think so. I think it really comes down to like how much of the hobbying aspect you like in your hobby, you know. So people who really like making terrain and really like painting figures tend to go for the snowy things because they just love making stuff. So they've already got all the temperate stuff they need anyway. So now it's like, hey, new challenge. But like even, you know, I didn't have, so for years I played it with just kind of regular miniatures and regular terrain. And it wasn't until a couple of years ago that I said, you know what, I'm going to actually paint up my Frostgrave warband and I'm actually going to put snow on the bases and stuff. So, you know, because I'm quite a slow painter. So it is a big commitment even to do 10 miniatures and, you know, limit them to kind of this setting. But but it was also a really fun project. You know, I wouldn't want to do an entire army that way. But with 10 figures, I thought, yeah, I can do this. And that's okay. Like, especially me, I know I'm going to play enough Frostgrave that the investment's going to be worth it. But, you know, if you're a very casual kind of player, you're going to want those figures to be usable for different settings. That's fine.
I want to ask you about your other games in a sec, but one last thing on Frostgrave is the second edition that was released last year?
Second edition.
So how terrified were you prior to that coming out, and how did things look once the dust settled? Were you quite content with it all?
I was pretty stressed. You know, on the one hand, I knew like I'm not making any massive changes in terms of the game. You know, I'm not changing any of the systems that I know people like. So the only thing I was really worried about was changing or replacing some of the spells, because I knew that there's going to be some people out there where I've just gotten rid of their favorite spell, even though, you know, the spells I got rid of either were because almost nobody used them or they weren't powerful enough or whatever. But you know, there was sure to be somebody. But, and also, just like anytime you release a rule book, you live in abject terror of someone going, on page 47, it says this, and you know, that's completely at
odds.
That's
a master quote. Say on
page 48. Yeah. It's like, oh no. But luckily we're now a year and a half removed and no one said that to me. So
yeah. I'm waking up in a cold sweat at night.
Yeah. And you know, like in some ways I didn't stress as much about that one as say a completely new game, because, you know, I did know that these systems work, you know, and there's no major problem. And I knew that, you know, the reason I was doing it was to clean up minor problems. So, you know, hopefully it'll be a better book. And I think it is. There is one, you know, there's a magic item that got left out, so you can roll it on the table and there's just no description of it in there, which you can find in the errata. But luckily I think that's the biggest mistake in the book, you know, everything. Other than that, there really isn't much, and it's all kind of just a few clarifications here and there. So it's gone down really well, and I'm really pleased in that. I think it is basically the same game that everybody knew and loved. It's just slightly better. It's just slightly more polished and, you know, better written and clearer. So
yeah, I mean, nobody could have accused you of doing a second edition for cynical reasons. You're not sitting on, but you know, shipping boxes of miniatures and stuff. Exactly. If anything, that would have been easier for you just to leave it alone, wouldn't it? So
yeah,
not put yourself through all that. But like I said, I did some pseudo research prior to having the chat. So I was seeing Rangers of Shadow Deep, a sort of solo co-op game, if I'm correct, came out March 2020, which I thought that was perfect timing. Then I saw Oathmark, Mass Fantasy Battle game, came out April 2020. I thought, couldn't have chose a worse time for that. So is that something that you noticed at the time, and you know, you lucked out on one end and had no luck on the other side?
Yeah, just, I guess, so Rangers of Shadowdeep actually came out a year and a half before that. But it was it was self-published, so it was only kind of available as a PDF or as print on demand through DriveThruRPG, and it had built up a pretty good following. But then I Modiphius talked me into letting them republish the book in a really nice edition, and yeah, it actually, I think, did benefit from lockdown. You know, I think all of a sudden everybody was looking for things that they could do in their house by themselves. And yeah, so I became one of the few people who, like, economically it might've worked out okay. But yeah, on the flip side, Oathmark got absolutely crushed by it. It was supposed to have a huge launch at Salute, and, you know, I was going to travel to a couple of places to do promotions for it. And of course, none of that happened. And more importantly, like, it's a game that you absolutely have to play with another person, and no one could for months on end. And when, you know, you've been in the industry for a while, you realize that, like, that first 6 months for any game is probably the most important it'll ever have. Because kind of basically, if it doesn't reach some sort of kind of critical mass in that time, then it'll just kind of fade away.
I was going to ask that, like, if I mean, it was circumstances outside your control, but, you know, the launch goes so badly because of the worldwide situation, can you come back from it and rescue? I'm not saying the game's dead by any means, but how do you get it back to the forefront of folks' minds?
Well, I mean, luckily there were a couple of expansions for it in the pipeline already, and so those have come out kind of regularly afterwards and kept it at the forefront of people's minds. And again, like, because it does have a range of miniatures with it, there's often new miniatures coming out, so again, you get those kind of advertising hits every time that happens. Beyond that, I don't know. I mean, you know, Oathmark's doing fine. It's bumping along, but you know, and you can never say what would have been. Maybe it's at the level it would have been anyway. You know, maybe that's just the natural level for that game. But there's part of me that says, man, it could have been so much bigger if things had gone better.
Yeah, not saying this will happen anytime soon, but was it in the works before the Old World Warhammer, the Old World, was announced? Which we might see in the next, 15 years or something?
Exactly. Yeah, it was. It was. So I'd been working on it for almost 2 years before it came out, or I started working on it about 2 years before it came out. So I don't I have no idea when that puts it. So 2017, I guess, I started working on it. So a long time, really. Because it was a much longer development process than any of my other games, really. And then you add in all the production as well. And yeah, it takes a long time to put a game out. So
what game has taken you out your comfort zone the most when you've been creating it?
That one, Oathmark. I'm not by nature a big battles gamer. And that's not because I don't like it. It goes back to my painting and being a slow painter and thus never being able to actually finish an army and thus rarely playing those games unless I'm using someone else's miniatures. I just love the look of a big fantasy army. There's nothing to kind of compare that to in fantasy miniatures. It's just a beautiful thing to see somebody's units all arrayed and, you know, all put together for that photo shoot. So, you know, it's still something I really love. But like having written Frostgrave and a couple other things before that, there's a couple of issues with a mass battle game that are just completely different. And they seem innocuous at first, but things like line of sight and maneuvers and, you know, and charges. Whereas from one figure to one figure, it's generally pretty easy. When you're dealing with units of figures, you start having to think, well, wait a minute, like how many of the figures in the unit have to be able to see or have to be able to charge into? Or so you start to have to deal with angles and that can get
tricky. Two huge units and they're touching corners, but they're fighting.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Yeah.
And you start to get into these issues if you realize, like, man, this is so hard to put into words, like on paper. If I was just standing next to somebody, this would be really easy to explain, you know, because I'd be able to go like this, like this, like this. But like on paper is really tough. And so I had to like continuously rewrite some of these rules that, you know, I thought, these are simple things. And then during playtesting, you realize these are not simple things because if you follow the rules as written, this happens. And it's like, oh, that's not what I want. So, and also it was the first time I had to deal with point values. I've done that. I do that, I guess, a little bit in something like Frostgrave where you have a cost to the figures, but frankly, it's not hugely relevant. Whereas in a game like this where you're purchasing all your units, where I guess the abilities of each unit are really important, then you got to use these point values, and you know, a lot has been written about point values over the years, and it's all true about how, you know, everything is just a guess. You know, when I did Oathmark, I started with a formula. This is the formula for how I take a figure's stats and convert it into a point value. And it worked well enough as long as I didn't dwell on it too much. Because, you know, so many things are circumstantial or, you know, well, so many things are circumstantial. They're only useful in given situations. And how do you assign a cost to something? How do you assign a cost to the ability to walk on water when you have no idea if there's going to be water on the table?
What's the recommended size of table for Oathmark? Is it 6'4"?
Yeah.
Yeah.
for the reason that because every other game is more than anything else. But
do you think that's just quite a natural size of table for 28mm scale?
I think it's natural because it's the size of two folding tables put together more than anything else. But yeah, I mean, I think it does work out in that for armies of a specific size, which is the size you're usually going to want to play with, it gives you a good evening's worth of gaming. With Oathmark, you might even get two in because it tends to play very fast, but there's plenty of maneuver room on that for most armies. So, you know, 4x4 is a little bit constrained on the flanks, which, you know, flanks play such a big part. I mean, in truth, you probably don't actually need the four. The six is probably more important than the four. You could probably do 6x3, and you're just, because even in the Oathmark rules, there's a rule about on the first turn, you can just kind of march towards the enemy and you don't have to do any of the special rolling or anything because frankly, that first turn's generally kind of dull. Because you don't need 4 feet. So,
for this month's question, I'd like you to reimagine your favorite film or TV show with the miniature hobby as its central plot. Imagine Andy in Toy Story getting a brand new army, much to the chagrin of his existing pile of unpainted miniatures. Or a terminally ill high school art teacher leading a double life as a commission painter in order to fund his treatment. From Honey, I Shrunk the Scale to 28mm Later, get your own reimagined film and TV show plot lines in over at bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail, and I need them in by Tuesday, the 29th of July. That's bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now back to the show.
Do the long narrow table. It could be like a gully or a mountain pass or something.
Exactly.
Big long stretch of carpet for them to march down.
The only people who want the 4 foot table are the elves. It's like, we need more shooting time. Make them walk.
I've talked about this on the podcast before with the big rank and flank mass fantasy battle games and the issue of the table and the layout and stuff, because I've always felt that the battle ends up concentrated. So I like to just have this big bit of space in the middle, almost like a prearranged like football park sitting there for them to meet and fight. And the terrain's all round about them, almost decorative.
Right.
And you look at a game like Frostgrave or games like Necromunda, where it's very, you know, the terrain is you're climbing, you're finding cover and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems a completely different world, the terrain on these mass games. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that people didn't understand when Frostgrave came out is I said, you know, it's got to be a crowded table. And like what I was envisioning for a crowded table is so far removed from what most people play with. It took people a while to figure out what that is. So now there's like, you go on the Facebook group or whatever and people be like, here's my table. And everybody's like, put more stuff on it. You know? Otherwise, you're just going to get fireballed to death. You know, for me, the perfect Frostgrave table is you take a box full of blocks and you just upend it on the table, you know, and
they're like,
there's the table. So,
yeah, that's fair. Nobody could complain about strategic placing of certain
exactly. So with Oathmark, I mean, obviously you're not going to have anywhere near that level of terrain. That said, I like, you know, terrain makes tables look cool and makes them fun to play on. Well, it makes them fun to be standing next to. Now, Oathmark tends to allow for a lot more movement and maneuver than a lot of rank and flank games. Units tend to be a bit more nimble. So terrain isn't quite as hugely limiting as it is in some rank and flank games. And thus you can have a bit more of it on the table without thinking this is going to just grind the game to a halt. You know, that said, you're not going to want to overload it. You are going to want plenty of rooms for units to clash and maneuver. But because that's what the game's about, and that's, you know, not what skirmish games are about. So you got to fit the table to suit the game.
I know we kind of moved on from Frostgrave, but we're going to talk about Stargrave as well. And I'm just curious, because I'm sure it was an interview with yourself that I talked about the wooden blocks, almost like, well, kids blocks. I got a set myself and just painted them up grey. And what are some of the most innovative, if I could say the word, and low-cost terrain features you've seen people in the community making for either of those games?
I mean, that's the big one. Yeah, take a box of blocks and just spray paint it grey. And like, you've just got every Frostgrave table you'll ever need. But also, like, I love I love the people that take the packing material, like the, you know, the cardboard that's form fitted to hold your new computer or whatever. And so you turn it upside down and it's got all kinds of the cool lumps and gullies. And, you know, again, spray that sucker gray and you've just got a whole block, you know, of the city or something. And, you know, and you don't, I think people get caught up on this idea of like, oh, I got it. It's got to look like ruins. And the truth is it really doesn't, because once you start playing, like your brain just takes over and your imagination takes over and that gray spray painted block or box will become the mausoleum or, you know, whatever. It's like, it's why virtual reality, I think, has never quite caught on as way in the way people thought it would, because actually it turns out just a video game's good enough, because the human brain is good at kind of filling in the cracks and, you know, puttying over all the problems, or, you know, in the case of a video game, blocking out anything that isn't the screen so that you're fully immersed without having to literally be fully immersed. And I think the same is true of a war game. Once you're playing it, and especially a skirmish one where you're like, you know, like Frostgrave, you're into the story of your wizard, you know, that's where you're starting. That's where your brain's starting from. You know, he is climbing over ruins, whatever those ruins actually are on the table. And that's when, you know, you're having fun.
Yeah. The imagination's a powerful thing. And like you say, it will fill in the blanks. You know, if things don't look entirely realistic, and let's face it, a table of miniatures doesn't look like a real setting. Like exactly. There's a lot, you know, people are walking about on stands and stuff. Your brain just casts that aside and gets on with the story, doesn't it? So
exactly. I mean, like, even when you play, because like you're doing mass battle and you put a building on it and you realize this building is either the smallest house that's ever been constructed or it's this massive, you know, palace. It, you know, the scale doesn't really make sense, but you don't care. So.
And like, here is my town, and it's got three houses.
Exactly.
Like, that's like just a rich guy.
Exactly. So. In the same way that, you know, your unit has 20 figures in it, which is, you know, this doesn't even qualify as a skirmish in real warfare, but it doesn't matter. That's representative.
That's a fight outside a chip shop.
Yeah.
So, mentioned that a couple of times now. Stargrave, when Stargrave was first sort of touted, and everyone's saying it's Frostgrave in space, how true or untrue was that statement?
You know, like, I don't know. It depends on, that's kind of like an eye of the beholder thing. It annoyed me when some people said, oh, it's just a reskin, because to me, a reskin is literally just changing terminology so that your crossbow becomes a rifle, you know. And that it absolutely isn't. You know, I spent a lot of work, a lot of time working on it and thinking about how, you know, what rules I needed to change or get rid of or add to bring the flavor of space to what was a familiar core system. You know, yeah, it uses the same combat system. It uses the same activation system. But so do lots of games, you know, sort of that change setting. But there's also a lot of rules that are different. And is it Frostgrave in space? Yes. In that, if you like the core mechanics of Frostgrave, you're going to find a lot of those familiar mechanics in Stargrave. But I wanted to make sure that playing the games felt different. And, you know, Frostgrave is a game where everybody generally has guns, and thus the tactics of what you do are very different. And some of the rules I've added are in there because of those tactics, and to reflect those tactics and to make some of them possible and make other things impossible. And so, you know, if you, I think, if you didn't like Frostgrave, you're probably not going to like Stargrave. And if you did like it, you probably will like it. But hopefully you'll find them different experiences. And, you know, and I've seen a couple of people say, like, I love Frostgrave, but I don't like Stargrave because of X, Y, and Z. And while I never like to hear anyone say, you know, I don't like your game, in some ways it's good to hear it because it shows these really are different games. You know, if you can mm-hmm. like one yeah. and dislike the other, there's enough difference between them. So,
mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah, true. Spring 2021, I think that came out. So we were in a more optimistic period then than yeah. probably when Oathmark came out. And obviously the buy-in in terms of getting, you know, your models to a location to play somebody else, it was going to be a lot easier too. So were you a lot less affected by the pandemic when Stargate came out?
You know, actually, I was probably more edgy about it because, you know, when Oathmark came out, one, like, it hadn't happened yet. We didn't know what pandemic meant, and there was literally nothing I could do about it anyway. It just happened. Mm. Whereas in the road leading up to Stargrave, so most of Stargrave was kind of developed during the pandemic and with no clear idea of what the world would look like when it actually came out. And then that's why, well, not why, but it's one of the reasons I wrote Dead or Alive, which is the kind of free supplement for Stargrave that basically allows you to play it solo, or at least it allows you to run a solo campaign based on bounty hunting. And so I didn't want to get into an Oathmark situation where my game came out and no one could play it. Cause you know, if nothing else, that's just a shame. And, as it turned out, it didn't really matter because at least in Britain and I think most of the world by that point, people were out of lockdown. But I think it also proves that just there is now more than ever before an appetite for solo wargaming and having that.
Do you like writing solo or co-op systems? Do you enjoy that?
I do and I don't. I do in that it, in some ways, it takes me back to my youth more because that's how I did most of my gaming as a child. Because I didn't have anyone to game with, or I didn't have enough people to game with. So I did a lot of solo gaming. So in some ways it takes me back. And in some ways I find it a more pure form of gaming in that the rules truly only matter as much as you want them to, because you're not beholden to anybody else. And thus, if you want to house rule something, you just do it literally while you're playing the game. And you don't have to worry about how that affects anybody else. And that's a huge amount of freedom comes from that. That said, it's a lot harder to write solo scenarios than it is competitive ones. You know, in competitive ones, you essentially just have to balance a scenario in the sense that both players have an equal chance of being affected by the special rules of the scenario. Whereas in solo gaming, you're having to think about the balance of how hard are all the traps, monsters, terrain features, you know, versus what the party is going, what the players' figures are going to be able to accomplish. And not only is it a question of like what's the chance of the player winning? It's figuring out what is the right chance for the player to win, by which I mean, if I'm creating a solo scenario, do I want the player to have about a 50-50 chance of winning? Do I want them to have a 75% chance of winning, a 25% chance? You know, because in some ways that really comes down to the player. Some players like it harder. Some people don't want it so hard. And so it's difficult to kind of balance that, and you have to think about that every time. And if a scenario is part of a campaign, how hard is each scenario in that campaign? And also when you're writing that scenario, there's just a lot more to write because you have to explain everything that the enemy is going to do. And the scenario is the enemy in that case. So like, the scenario has to do more things. It has to have more moving parts than a competitive one does to make it interesting, because you don't have the interest of another player you're competing against. So the scenario needs to be more intricate to provide that interest. So, so it's just a solo scenario. There's a lot more design and construction to it But that can be really fun. It can also be a headache and difficult.
Tell me a wee bit about Silver Bayonet then.
Okay. Silver Bayonet is as close as I'll ever come to writing a historical war game. Probably. It's basically take the Sharps series on TV and you get to play Sharp and his few chosen men, against another little group of Sharp and his men, but there's also werewolves running around. so it's Napoleonic Gothic horror. And, so the idea is that each player has this kind of handpicked unit of Napoleonic soldiers. So you pick a nation, and then you got a big list of kind of soldiers you can draw from. So like the British can have a red coat, they can have a rifleman, they can have sailors, they can have officers, they can have artillerists, and you know, some more esoteric stuff. And you round up your little party of like eight guys. And you've got your officer who's more of a character and he's got some special abilities you get to choose. And the other player does the same. But instead of kind of fighting because you're British and he's French, you're fighting because you're both wanting to get this occult tome, or you know there is a troll who has probably accumulated some interesting artifacts in this place, or you're looking for some mystical artifact from something, but it's in this old haunted castle. So you are going to shoot at those French because they're trying to take the same thing you want, but actually in some ways you're more worried about this ghost that's floating around and potentially just going to hurt you real bad. And it's very much about, you can kind of choose some special equipment for all your guys, and each of the kind of monsters you might encounter, ghosts or vampires or werewolves, have specific weaknesses. So obviously the silver bayonet is a reference to having a weapon to fight a werewolf. But not all your guys are going to have a silver bayonet, because some of them might be carrying, you know, garlic or salt or, you know, fire to fight other things. And so when you encounter that werewolf, you have to make sure you can maneuver the guys that have the things that can fight the werewolf into the right place. But of course, you know, the French are over there sniping at you, kind of hoping that werewolf mauls you. And
if a wee holiday at Tallinn helped inspire the idea behind Frostgrave, what were you up to when you came up with this idea?
I think
you're doing a lot of drugs.
I think what it is, so I worked at Osprey for, 14 years. And most of that time, you know, the main thrust of Osprey and the main thrust of my job was military history, you know, publishing these books that really were for war gamers to know how to paint their miniatures. They were uniform guides. And so I just saw all these beautiful illustrated books of military uniforms, and the best ones were Napoleonic. Like, it is without a doubt the most colorful, beautiful, interesting era of military uniforms.
It's like the wanted shot back then.
Exactly.
Please shoot me.
And like, I've always wanted to paint some of those minis, but I've never wanted to paint an army. And I've never really wanted to be completely beholden to accuracy. So as much as I loved looking through those books, I just saw them as like, these are cool options, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I wanted a game where I could paint up a handful of Napoleonics, and A, they wouldn't have to be a unit in the sense of they're all British line, thus they all have to wear red coats and have, you know, green cuffs and blah, blah, blah. Each one could be individual, and each one could, you know, this guy might be a British line infantryman, so he could be dressed exactly as the 95th was or whatever. But, well, 95th was rifles, but, you know, some line unit. But also he could have thrown away his Shako and got a floppy hat because, you know, he's kind of a specialist. So they only sort of follow the rules. So I wanted to give people like the excuse to paint Napoleonic miniatures, but also the freedom to not worry at all about getting it right. They can, you know, if you get the fun out of that, then absolutely go for it. But if you don't, then just take the miniature and kind of paint it any way you want. And at the same time, like, I can't do anything apparently without sticking fantasy in there. So,
yeah, you know? I think that this game is going to be really cool to see what people are doing with it, because it gives you so much opportunity, whether that's existing historical stuff you've got, or maybe, you know, people like myself that have never really got into the historical, gives you an excuse to buy 5 or 6 or 7 guys and
paint them up. It's a really low buy-in, you know, kind of. And really, like, I've realized that so much of my job is to just give people an excuse to buy minis, because, you know, that's, again, like, that's what we really love, are these little miniature figurines. And our rules tend to be the excuse to acquire those. so here's your excuse to get Napoleonic ones, plus some gothic-y, you know, monsters to go along with them.
Will you do a wee solo rule set for that as a precaution?
It's already in the book. So
cool. These are the times, aren't they? That'll probably be, everyone will just do that now.
Yeah. Well, I realized, like, I think from working on other things, it's like, not only is this great in the sense that if something happens, you can still play it, it's great in the sense that it gives you an opportunity to play the game as soon as you buy it, if you want to. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It gives you a way to test out the rules before you have to play with somebody else. And it gives you a way to play it if you don't have, you know, if you're between games with other people and just want more. And Silver Bayonet for me was also just a real opportunity to make sure I could design another system. Because, you know, with Stargrave and Frostgrave and even Rangers of Shadowdeep, they do use a lot of the same core mechanics. And I didn't feel those core mechanics quite matched what I wanted for Silver Bayonet. You know, as has been much commented upon, the Frostgrave system is quite wild. Swingy is the popular term, but because you're rolling that D20, and that's how I want it to be. I want those games to be wild and, you know, for the surprising to happen. And while I want that to some extent in the Silver Bayonet, I didn't want it quite as much. I wanted the game to be slightly more controlled. And so part of that is, instead of rolling a D20, you are rolling 2D10. You're using them in a different way than you are in Frostgrave. And also you've got ways to manipulate those rolls that you don't have in Frostgrave. So you've got a kind of fate pool where you can bring in dice and re-roll them and stuff. So there's a little more player control. And because you didn't have the spells that you have in Frostgrave giving you that big decision-making element every turn, this fate pool and how you use it and how you modify your dice rolls becomes an interesting element of player decision, which I think is important in any game. So.
Yeah, really looking forward to that. So that comes out in the winter. Is it November, I think I've seen?
Yeah, I think so. Like, it's really hard as an author, I suppose, to kind of remember schedules, because...
You've done your part now, haven't you?
Exactly. I've actually got Silver Bayonet sitting on my shelf. And, you know, as the author advance. And in some ways, I haven't really thought about the game in its kind of basic mechanics for months now. And I'm deep into a Stargrave thing at the moment. So, but that won't be seen for a year and a half. you're always kind of off what people are talking about. So.
Yeah. Working on the next thing.
Yep.
Joe, it's been a brilliant chat. We're approaching the end just now. Where might the listener be able to go and check out your stuff, should they desire, and why wouldn't they?
Yeah, well, if you want the one-stop shop for everything, then I would say go to North Star Military Figures, at least in the UK, because not only do they carry all of my games, but they've also got all of the figures, official figures for them, if you want to go official figures. Obviously, Osprey publishes most of my games, so you can go to the Osprey site and see them all there. I do some self-publishing on DriveThruRPG, so while you can get Rangers of Shadowdeep, the basic game from Modiphius, all the supplements for it are currently on DriveThru, and you can get them as PDFs or you can get them print on demand. And if you just kind of want to keep up with me, I've got a blog called The Renaissance Troll at blogspot.com, I think. Google The Renaissance Troll and blog, and it'll be the only thing that comes
can't,
up.
I can't spell. You could pay me all the money on earth. I can't spell Renaissance. I know.
It's taken me years of having a blog with that name to be able to do it. But if you get close enough, Google's smart and it'll figure it out. So,
yeah.
But you can find me there. And not only kind of is that going to have all the updates on my work, but it's also got my hobby, because I like to put up the miniatures I'm painting or the games I'm playing or the whatever I'm working on. Because, you know, this isn't just my job. This is my fun too. So
thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.